listening to Radio Regent. My name is Norman Richmond, and joining me on the line from somewhere in the third world is Dr. Gerald Horn. How are you doing today, my good friend?
Fine, thank you, and yourself?
Oh, wonderful. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I mean, you can turn it up some.
All right. I guess today is a very, very, we have a lot of territory to cover. We got Africa, we have the Snowden situation, and you have something out here about the crackdown on the mafia in Italy, plus China, and some more about China. But can we talk about the elections in Zimbabwe? I haven't seen a word about the elections in Zimbabwe in the local press here in Toronto. How is it being covered in the United States and elsewhere?
It's the same here, but that's good news, because when you get attention on a country like Zimbabwe, that inevitably trickles into the left and influences the left. I recall the last elections in Zimbabwe in 2008, I thought some of the friends in Pacifica Radio were going to put on green fatigues and parachute into Harare and personally arrest Robert Mugabe and frog march him to The Hague to stand trial. I mean, they were fired up. But now the temperatures have cooled in the North Atlantic countries about Zimbabwe. You know, there have been overtures with regard to the European Union to Zimbabwe. The United States sent a number of special emissaries in recent months to meet with President Mugabe, including Andrew Young, the black American who formerly served as mayor of Atlanta and former United Nations ambassador for the United States. And so the temperature has cooled considerably. A lot of this has to do with failures of the opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change under Margaret Tsvangirai. Many people in Zimbabwe feel that his being designated as prime minister basically took the fire out of his movement to a certain extent. Now he's known for his various affairs. In fact, you know, this is not People magazine, so I'd be the last person to talk about someone's personal life, but quite frankly, that's become an issue in the election campaign. A lot of women voters have been turned off to Mr. Tsvangirai because of what is perceived as his shambolic treatment of women. And then his Movement for Democratic Change is split into two or three different factions. If they had united, they'd have a much better chance with regard to the elections on July 31st. Speaking of which, it's difficult to say who's going to prevail. I mean, the opposition press says the opposition is going to prevail. The ZANU-PF-oriented press says that Mr. Mugabe will prevail. I know that the African Union has basically given the election preparations a clean bill of health, although this has been hotly contested by the MDC and its allies, particularly its allies across the border in South Africa amongst the European population, who are quite frightened that if Zimbabwe turns out to re-elect Mr. Mugabe, then there will be more pressure on the European minority in Zimbabwe, which inevitably will ricochet across the border into South Africa. It's no secret that the movement in Southern Africa is at a new stage, going from political liberation, that is to say the ouster of the Rhodesians in 1980, the ouster of the apartheid regime in 1994, to economic liberation, which is much more protracted, much more difficult, much more messy. And you know what happened when the ZANU-PF moved against the European farmers, many of whom had only arrived in the country in 1945. They were basically given land grants as a result of their serving in the British Army during World War II. And then they were expropriated in the 1990s, a few decades after their arrival, and this caused hell to break loose, including, as I said, in Pacifica Radio, where I don't think that ostensibly they were concerned about the expropriation of European farmers. I think that they were more concerned about what they thought to be were human rights violations. But if that were the case, one wonders why they don't talk more about Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, and other countries where they're expensive North American interests, particularly oil interests, and where elections are basically a figment of the imagination. But in any event, we'll be eagerly and anxiously awaiting the results of the election in Zimbabwe on July 31st.
July 31st, that's next Monday or Tuesday, right?
Well, you know, do the math. Today is the 28th, and tomorrow is the 29th, and from there.
Now, the Egypt update, I was listening to The World last night, and they had someone on from the Financial Times who was very sympathetic to Morsi. And then after that, they spoke to someone at Kent State that was very critical of the situation. They seemed to be in support. They seemed to be anti the situation. They seemed to be for anti the whole regime. I know we talked about it last week, but could you give us an update on Egypt?
Well, you know, I heard those interviews also on The World. And by the way, The World, you know, it's interesting. I mean, some of the reporting on Russia, though, is just really terrible. I mean, it's to the right of NATO, and that takes some doing to get to the right of NATO. But in any case, I think the problem is this, that in order to be sympathetic to the new regime in Cairo, you have to be sympathetic to the military, and you have to, which are basically ousted President Morsi, and you have to be sympathetic to the Saudis, who are bankrolling the new military-backed regime, and you have to be sympathetic to the Salafists, who are to the right of the Muslim Brotherhood, and basically make the Muslim Brotherhood seem like Girl Scouts, but participated in the coup against President Morsi. The long and the short of it is that the situation in Egypt is very complicated and very complex and does not easily admit to easy answers. I mean, we know what happened yesterday after Friday prayers. I mean, a number of Morsi supporters were killed. And we know that just as during the reign of President Morsi, the liberal and secular forces would not negotiate with President Morsi or even take any cabinet posts. They just wanted him gone. And now the Muslim Brotherhood says they won't negotiate with the military because they see the military coup, to use that term, as being illegitimate and illegal, and so they won't negotiate with the military. So basically, we move from one standoff to another standoff. And it's a very dangerous moment. It's a very perilous moment. And all we can really say, I guess, on this side of the Atlantic is basically that any interference in the internal affairs by external forces, which, of course, is a specialty of intelligence services, which will go unmentioned in North America, that we would hope that that sort of external interference would cease, and we should pressure to make sure that that external interference ceases.
One more question about Egypt. Now, what is Mr. Morsi being charged with?
Hello?
No, I said, what is Mr. What is the Mr. Morsi? What is
Well, you know, he apparently broke out of prison as the Mubarak regime was deteriorating, and the prison break apparently involved some violence. And so he's being charged there. The rather tubby 56-year-old Mr. Morsi is being portrayed as a kind of a Rambo figure
right,
with regard to this. He's being charged with regard to espionage, which apparently connects to his relationship with Hamas.
Hamas, right.
Which is generally seen as a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate, which, as you know, rules in Gaza, in the Palestinian territories. But I don't know. I see a slow motion tragedy unfolding in Egypt, and it's very sad to see, I must confess.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, scholar activist based in Houston, Texas. Now we wanted to move to Mali. Last night, I didn't hear tonight on one of the shows that's on CBC, they're going to be talking about the music in Mali dealing with the elections. I don't have any information. I know they have some of the great musicians coming out of Mali, female and male. There was one brother, I think, that came from the Cote d'Ivoire, who moved to Mali. He's a great vocalist. But when are the elections in Mali, and what is your analysis of these elections?
The elections are tomorrow, and as you know more than most, this has been a stormy 12 to 16 month period in the history of modern Mali. It's fair to say that when the NATO forces led by the United States bombed Libya and ousted Colonel Gaddafi in 2011, and I might say once again that, interestingly enough, some of our friends on the left supported that NATO bombing campaign against Colonel Gaddafi, even though our friends on the left who supported that campaign consider themselves to be inflexibly hostile to Obama, yet they supported Obama's major blunder. Now, if you can explain that to me, I'll be more than willing to listen. But in any case, what happens after the fall of Gaddafi is that ricochets throughout the region. It leads to many of the Malians who had been in Libya fleeing to Mali, including many Tuareg forces, who have many unresolved grievances against the Bamako regime. They revolt in northern Mali and then are quickly supplanted by so-called Islamists, including forces apparently allied to Al-Qaeda. They take over a large swath of Malian territory and begin to impose draconian rules, particularly persecuting women, beating women in the streets, for example, for various transgressions. You also know in one of the major tragedies of this century that many of the manuscripts of northern Mali, stretching back hundreds of years, containing a storehouse of intellectual firepower of Africans with regard to astronomy and literature and poetry and all the rest, basically the Islamists decided that this wasn't worth preserving, so they just destroyed it. They didn't destroy all of it, but they destroyed quite a bit of it. And I don't know. It's a very sad and tragic situation. This led to a French-led intervention in Mali, which ousted the Islamists, which then led to the United Nations forces, the Blue Helmets, supposedly going to take over from France. I should also say that in the turmoil generated in northern Mali, you had the attack on an energy installation in Algeria that led to the deaths of dozens of nationals from the United States and other Japan and other leading capitalist countries. You also had, as a result of the coming to power of these Islamists before they were ousted by the French, a growth of that tendency throughout the Sahel region of Africa. It gave a jolt in the arm to, for example, to Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, which specializes in blowing up churches. It led directly to an attack on a uranium facility in Niger. It's also led to increased and enhanced drone warfare, spearheaded by the United States in the Sahel region. So all in all, I think it's fair to say that this attack on Libya was a major disaster. And I think our friends on the left who supported that campaign really have some explaining to do. I mean, that's the problem with the left, is that they stumble from blunder to blunder and never give an explanation. I mean, it's really incredible. No accountability. They never go back and engage in some self-analysis or self-criticism so we can get an understanding of how they can make such atrocious blunders. But in any case, an election is taking place tomorrow. Interestingly enough, the both leading candidates, Ibrahim Keita and Somaya Cisse, are seen as in the French sphere of influence. It raises another question. That is to say, we've talked on Radio Region more than once about how so many black people in Toronto are so concerned about China and Africa, but yet they have nothing to say about France and Africa. I mean, what are they, Quebec? I mean, you know, where are these people? Don't they realize that France is the major vampire in Africa? Why don't they talk about France and Africa? Can you answer me that?
I think some of them some do, but I think there's many do, but I think that I think people have bought the West take on China. It's worse, I think, worse than L.A. in terms of when I say worse, because every other day there is an anti-China article in the Los Angeles Times on Times front page, second page. It is a problem. But I had something to ask you. Have you ever heard of Dr. Abdullah Hakeem Quick? He lives here in Toronto. He's a Muslim, and he did a film on Timbuktu. I think he's originally out of Boston, and he has Barbadian roots. But he was the imam in South Africa. He was also the imam in Jamaica. Have you ever seen his film or heard of him?
No, although I have seen some interesting films on Timbuktu made by the United Nations. They're all free of charge. You can find them online. They're very informative. If I were trying to search online, I would search under United Nations and then capital letters IRIN.
Right.
And you ought to be able to come up with those films. They've done films, all free films. You can download them. You can watch them now.
They're all
very informative.
I would also suggest that you go and check out Dr. Abdullah Hakeem Quick. He's the, as the last time I heard, I think he's the imam here in Toronto. But he's been on Saturday Morning Live several times, and he's a good friend of Radio Region, so on and so forth. Now,
before we go on, let me continue on Mali. I mean, the turnout in presidential elections in Mali usually are not very high, which befits a colony of France. Sometimes they're lucky to get 39% participation, believe it or not. And participation is made even more problematic by the dislocation brought by the French invasion of Mali. There are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands internally displaced persons in Mali, and refugees in neighboring Mauritania, in Niger, and Burkina Faso. The electoral roll has not been adequately compiled as a result of this dislocation. So in many ways, this is a rushed election to try to put a smiley face on a very ugly situation, that is to say, a situation that is a direct product of French colonialism. And one more footnote before we go on, I would suggest that those concerned about China, what they really should be concerned about is China's role in Asia. And that's a justifiable concern. And it could really mean a new world war. And I do not say that with any glee or happiness. Tensions between China and Japan are escalating. The situation with regard to China and India and territorial disputes are unresolved. The Vietnamese president was just in the White House meeting with President Obama in the last 24 to 48 hours. And we all know about the conflicts between Vietnam and China over the years, particularly in the last decade or two. Conflicts between China and the Philippines continue to simmer and boil. And this is a very dangerous situation. It's very perilous. And I would hope that the brain power that, to me, is looking at a non-issue, in my opinion, with regard to China and Africa, would really concentrate on a real issue, which is China and Asia, which could mean the doom for us all.
Speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, but there was an item I heard on the radio about Indian troops preparing in the mountains of India, to thousands of Indian troops being trained to deal with a possible attack from China into India, and also the state head of state of Vietnam. What is your assessment of Vietnam? Do you think that they're still socialists moving towards communism, or should we buy the hype that they're a capitalist country now?
Well, I gave a speech in Chicago in mid-June 2013 that you can find online. And one of the things I said in that speech is that the idea that socialist countries or now all capitalist countries, which is quite prevalent in North America, is one of the most profound collective delusions since the Salem witch trials of the late 17th century in Massachusetts. I mean, it's delusional. I mean, certainly many of these countries had to take a step back with the collapse of the Soviet Union, but they still have large state sectors. They still have communist parties in power. Many of them still are being undermined relentlessly by the NATO countries. And so when a British intellectual like Martin Jacques can publish, as he did, a very credible book in 2009 with the title, quote, When China Rules the World, unquote, I think it's delusional to think that somehow the basics that led to the Cold War have disappeared. Now, sure, I mean, as you know, I've been a critic of China while some of these present-day critics were still in short pants and little boy pants. But at the same time, I'm also a person who tries to recognize reality. And the reality is twofold. Number one, that countries like China and Cuba and Vietnam are still on the path to socialism. And at the same time, there are many obstacles strewn in their path, not least being what I just articulated concerning China and Asia, in which you just basically adverted to when you talked about the territorial dispute between China and India, which is very serious, very profound, and could spell doom for us all.
You're listening to Radio Regent. This is Saturday Morning Live, and on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn. We need to move on to Mr. Snowden. Now, this situation is... This gentleman is still in, still in Russia. What is your take on his situation?
Well, the latest news is that the U.S. administration has sent a letter to their Russian counterparts promising that if Mr. Snowden is returned to North America, he will not be tortured, he will not be subjected to the death penalty. Now, look, anybody who knows anything about U.S. history knows that these people here, they don't believe in keeping agreements. Ask the Native Americans if you don't believe me. And so it's laughable that they would send such a letter to Moscow, because, I mean, who believes these people? I mean, please. In any case, Mr. Snowden is now negotiating, or at least his lawyers are negotiating with the Russian authorities to leave the transit zone of the Moscow airport, where he's been holed up for weeks now. The latest news is apparently he's just going to stay put in Moscow. He's not going to try to make it to Latin America, although I think that that may be a feint. As I said on Radio Regent last week, what I predict is that he will put on some weight, get a new haircut, grow a beard, take off his glasses, get a prosthesis, drive to Belarus, fly to Buenos Aires. That's what I predict.
So he's going to be looking like Ernesto Che Guevara when he disappeared.
Exactly.
Right.
And it shouldn't be that hard to pull off.
And do you think the Russians are holding on to a firm position, or you think they are? Russia has a lot to make up in terms of the whole Libya situation. I guess that taught them a lesson that they should have comprehended before, though, don't you think?
Sure, and there's another lesson, too, which we all should infer from the Snowden situation. That is to say, the Chinese passed the hot potato, that is Mr. Snowden, to Moscow. As Fidel Castro said, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's really only Russia that seems to be willing to stand up to the NATO countries. That's why you still have a NATO. It was designed to keep Russia in check. And it's amazing that after all these years and all these decades that some of our friends on the left refuse to recognize that reality, although it slaps us in the face at every opportunity.
Let's move on to the crackdown on the mafia in Italy.
Well, the only reason I mentioned that is that As you know, there's this phenomenon called organized crime, sometimes referred to as the mafia. And it developed, at least the modern interpretation is that developed in the late 19th century, at least what we refer to as Italian-based organized crime developed in the late 19th century in Italy as Italy was coming together as a modern state, although, of course, you have branches of organized crime in every country in the world, including Montreal, by the way. But the reason I bring this up is that there's a lot of discussion, and we discussed it on Radio Regent some days ago with regard to racial profiling and the Trayvon Martin situation, because obviously he was subjected to racial profiling. But what's remarkable is that in Boston, Massachusetts, as we speak, there's a trial of Italian-American and Irish-American gang figures who basically have had a stranglehold on organized crime in Boston. And as this trial reveals, they've been involved in murder, child abuse, extortion, shakedowns, drug dealing, pedophilia, and that's just the least of their crimes. And they made millions in the process. And so one would think that if people were sincerely interested in using race or ethnicity as a marker for crime, that there'd be some sort of profiling of Italian Americans and Irish Americans. But there's no talk of it. Just the other day on Wall Street, a billionaire hedge fund manager, Stephen Cohen, his firm has been charged criminally with insider trading, which has a much more disruptive impact on the economy, perhaps, than that scene in Boston that I've just described, and certainly more than what black youth are charged with. And certainly, Mr. Cohen, who is Jewish American, and I say this not to indict any community, but just to make a point, he comes with a long line of Jewish American investors involved in financial transgressions and manipulations in recent years, including Ivan Boesky, Dennis Levine, Michael Milken. But there's no talk about using Jewishness as a marker for tracking crime on Wall Street. So what is it, Norman? Are these people, are they just saying that you should only use markers of race when it comes to black and Latinos, and that you should ignore markers when it comes to other groups? Is that what we should infer from this?
Well, I think that what William Edward Burghardt Du Bois said in, I think it was 1903, is it's still, the color line is still a problem. Not the only problem, but it's still, it hasn't disappeared. That's how I see it.
It's quite remarkable. And what's even more remarkable is that that second discourse that I mentioned, you can't even talk about it hypothetically. You lose your job. You talk about it hypothetically, not as, whereas it's a policy to have racial profiling of black people in the United States, whereas other kind of profiling, you can't even talk about it in jest, hypothetically, or otherwise. It's really astonishing.
But don't you
say, once again, our friends on the left have little to say about that.
I guess the last thing I want to ask you is about the Malaysian spearhead group. What is
the Melanesian spearhead group? The only reason I mention that, the Melanesians are the forgotten black people, even though, as I said in my book, The White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War, that there's credible evidence to suggest that the Melanesians, who look like you, who look like me, they're dark-skinned people with, quote, woolly locks, unquote, that their roots are really in East Africa. There's linguistic evidence to suggest that, in terms of the Fijian language, for example. And yet, they're sort of forgotten black people. I mean, you have all of these chest-thumping black nationalists, and they never talk about the Melanesians, even though they have a group, the Melanesian Spearhead Group, which brings together people from Fiji and Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands and all of the rest. And they have some very big problems right now because, one, Australia is the heavyweight power in the South Seas. And Australia, as you might guess, and they're White Australia policy, which only dissipated in the 1960s, Australia's policies towards the Melanesians has been quite racist. Then another problem is that Irian Jaya, which shares an island with Papua New Guinea and is otherwise known as West Papua, is under the administration of the Indonesians, and the Indonesians have been waging a low-level war in Irian Jaya for years. It's not clear to me if independence is the proper route for Irianjaya or West Papua, but certainly it's an inflamed territorial conflict. But once again, it gets hardly any attention, and I thought that since the Melanesian Spearhead Group had just had its meeting within the past week, it would be an opportunity to bring some of their issues to a wider audience.
Next week, do you think we can dedicate about 5 more minutes to that situation? Because I think that's something we need to really discuss. I think Renoko Rashidi is doing a lot of work alerting people about the people. When we talk about African people, a lot of time we leave the Pacific Isles out of the equation.
Well, you know, what it reminds me of is baseball, believe it or not. As you know, there are a number of Dominicans, people from the Dominican Republic in Major League Baseball, dark-skinned people of African descent. And from my research on Hispaniola, one of the things that I'm pursuing is the fact that in the 1820s, thousands of Africans from Canada and the United States migrated to Hispaniola at the invitation of the Haitian government. And many of them moved to these two communities in Samana and Puerto Plata. And so, interestingly enough, in a certain sense, the people who are there, at least many of them, could fairly be called Afro-North American, for example. And yet, they're not considered to be, as Torrey Hunter, the outfielder of the Detroit Tigers, said when asked about all the Latin ball players. He says, well, you know, they're all okay, but, you know, all these Dominicans, they're really not our people, you know. And so, I guess when you move, you lose your membership card, I guess. I guess that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, Torrey Hunter is one of my favorite players, but when he made that statement, I was very disappointed. I thought he had a little bit more sense than that.
Hanley Ramirez, who's one of the best hitters in baseball, although he hasn't had a good year this year, plays with the Dodgers. He used to play with what was then the Florida Marlins. He's
right
in that area, for
right
example. I mean, you can look it up. You'll find a number of those players. I haven't tracked down George. Remember George Bell?
Yeah, he's in George Bell. I thought George Bell was Puerto Rican.
Oh, he was Puerto Rican. Okay.
Yeah.
He was Dominican.
No,
okay.
I think he's Puerto Rican because they had a guy on the sports channel yesterday, and he mentioned the fact that he had spoken to George Bell. Now, maybe he might be Dominican and he's living in Puerto Rico, but I know he was reported to be in Puerto Rico the other day. But I'll check it out and see what I can about George Bell.
Please do.
All right, and Carlos Delgado they gave him a big ceremony a couple of days ago in Toronto.
Yeah, I noticed that. What was that all about?
They inducted. He's on the Wall of Fame in the stadium. They put him up with Cito Gaston and all the big boys. So he was recognized. Nice ceremony.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
All right, sir. So we will see you in the whirlwind, my good friend.
Take care. Bye bye.
All right. Take care. And we have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. We will see you in the whirlwind. We will be right back.